This episode of The Grape Nation is brought to you by Vivino. Discover and buy wines wherever you are. Visit vivino.com/heritage to stock up.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup. This week, we're celebrating Pride. We speak to the bakers who created a custom wedding cake for Charlie Craig and David Mullins, the couple behind the Masterpiece Cake Shop Supreme Court case.
We felt that what happened to Charlie and David was an absolute injustice.
Kat Johnson addresses the controversy surrounding Anthony Porosky, Queer Eye's food and wine expert.
Many viewers thought these recipes were unsophisticated.
And finally, Hannah Forden speaks with nutrition educator Leah Kurtz about the relationship between veganism and queer identity.
It's an interesting way in which food can challenge invisible value systems even greater than sexuality does.
Listen to Meat and Three, that's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, this week, and celebrate Pride with HRN. Available on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening apps.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guests are Sharon Harris and Beth Mon-Benz. We'll talk to Sharon and Beth about wine, women in wine, and a lot more. For our weekly wine sip, we'll taste a Greek wine with Beth in the studio. I'm your host, Sam Ben-Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Sharon Harris is the proprietor of Rare Cat Wines in Napa, California. She is a winemaker and entrepreneur committed to empowering women, using wine as a tool to elevate women and promote diversity. She just completed a 23-city tour preaching these issues. Beth Mon-Benz is a wine consultant, sommelier, and worked in wine retail. Beth has had a long career in wine in New York City at some of the finest restaurants, including Milos, Judson Grill, the U.S. Open, and Porterhouse. Beth was slinging wine before becoming a sommelier was a thing. We'll talk to Sharon first. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Sharon.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here in New York.
Just for a little background, Sharon is based out of Napa and in France, but we met up in New York and we're sitting down at Marta. And I wanted to ask Sharon a bunch of things about why she's here. But first, Sharon, give our listeners a little background. Spend a few minutes telling me about your journey in life and wine that got you really to two places, Rare Cat. And one of the reasons I really wanted you here is, you know, your support of empowering women through wine.
Absolutely.
So let's buzz through this. There's a lot to do.
So I do not come from a wine family. So my path to discovering and loving wine is from a path because I wanted to speak French from a very, very young age. It's funny, last night at a major wine event, I was talking, I really think the influences of why I loved and wanted to speak French was possibly because of nursery rhyme, Frère Jacques, and possibly because of Pepe Le Pew, one of my favorite cartoons. So I'm pretty sure I'm in the wine industry because of a skunk and a nursery rhyme.
Okay.
But I
Probably a first.
Right. Yeah, I think it's unique. But I did try to graduate early from high school. That didn't go well for me to move to France. So when I was at UCLA my junior year abroad, I applied and got accepted to a program to spend a junior year abroad in France. To be honest, I thought it was going to be Paris. At the time, I don't think I had a perspective that anything existed outside of Paris. And of course, I got sent to Bordeaux.
Wow.
And at the time, I asked a great friend of mine, what did they do in Bordeaux? And the answer was, I think they make wine there. So I show up to Bordeaux, 1983, 20 years old, with, I would say, zero knowledge of wine. And my first great epiphany to wine was literally November 1983, knocking on the door of O'Brien and spending the day with Michel Dunmas.
Top of the game.
Top of the game. Zero to top of the game. And literally, that was it. It just hook, line, and sinker fell in love with wine. I got to taste the famous 82
wow.
out of the barrel, a 66 that he had opened.
Wow.
I didn't understand how the components got into the wine, but that was it. And fell in love with the French culture, with French food, with French wine. Certainly that joie de vivre lifestyle of coming to the table, sharing wine, building community. And I think that's been an influence now. Well, it changed my life.
So you did that junior year, you came back, you finished school?
I did. I actually graduated top of my class in international economics.
A
little plug, because I took it, instead of taking the banking jobs, I took a one-way ticket back to France, and I worked in a two-star restaurant underneath the North African stagiaire. So it was so low, they hadn't invented the level. And I worked in a French kitchen, and I really understood, you know, I learned a tremendous amount about cooking and just sourcing of food and the hierarchy, and actually I learned quite a lot of how to speak French.
Good background.
Not always great French, but nonetheless a lot of French.
So then what happens?
Then I ran out of money.
Okay.
Yeah, sometimes it happens. Practical. And right. I had to come back, and I got jobs in technology. I ran a... worked for a tech publishing company, went back, got an MBA in international marketing. My whole focus was always international, trying to figure out how I could get back to France. Ran an international division for a tech publishing company, went to a search engine company in the mid-90s.
This is before tech really blew up too, right?
Well, it was, but the search engine company I worked for, Inc2Me, did go from zero to $36 billion.
Jeez. So.
I was VP of sales at that company, and
Jesus.
So that allowed me to follow my passion, which had always been wine. And it was interesting through that kind of that career path, as I was often the only woman at the table. This is early tech. Internationally, no business is done in a conference room. It is always done outside of a conference room through business dinners. And it was really profoundly interesting because I was an outlier. I was a woman. I didn't look like anyone else at the table, but I was also a woman who knew a lot about wine and had a deep passion for wine. So it allowed me to be invited to places that were often not available, men's clubs, dinner tables. I controlled the wine list. I ordered the wines. And all of a sudden, I had this incredible career. And I have to say, wine was a big part of getting me to the table. But all of those subconscious biases that happen when you know how to order wine, head of the table, control the table, talk about wines, cultural currency. And it was really interesting.
You're the man, even though you're the woman.
That's right.
That's right. Very cool.
And people do business with people they like and trust. And it was one of those components of connecting with across gender, across culture. It was something that allowed me to be able to be accepted at a table because I could talk about wine.
So that's the business world. You eventually get out of that and morph purely into wine. Talk to me about when, where, and how.
So, I mean, I was fortunate to be able to take some money out of tech and buy a couple other wineries. I bought property and planted vineyards in 2000 in Napa Valley. And really then I would say that was the start of the journey, because then I returned back to the University of Bordeaux.
Wait, what does that mean? So you made money in the business world.
Yeah.
You were able to fund your wine passion. You bought property or?
Correct. I bought a property and planted
and
vineyards
planted
in 2000.
And you planted 2000?
Yeah, Hillside Vineyards in Calistoga.
Okay.
I bought into another winery, a majority share of another winery, and eventually bought a second property up in Calistoga. Had partners on those with those wineries. But probably the biggest change is I went back and I studied winemaking from 2004 to 2006 at the University of Bordeaux. And after that, I returned directly back to St. Helena, and I started Rare Cat in 2008. Our first vintage was the 2009 vintage.
So in 2004, what drove you to the idea that I got to get back to France. And you have kids and everything now, a family.
Kids,
you're not
town.
Running on the fly here. What? That's a bold, big step.
It was a huge, bold step. I had a 5 and 7 year old in tow, moved to Bordeaux. It was a big step. I think there was a couple of compelling reasons. I think, you know, having my children live outside of the U.S. and experience another culture was, I use the word profound too often, but it was a profound experience, you know, for them. It changed who they were. They learned French, but they also understood what it was like to be an outsider, to be the foreigner. And I think that has, you know, influenced how kind they are with people from, regardless of where they're from. And so possibly that's a benefit. But
great
two,
experience.
Why would I go to UC Davis? Everyone in California goes to UC Davis.
But you went to Bordeaux specifically for a degree.
Wine.
What did you wind up coming back with?
So the program I studied was part of the Oenology department. It's called the Diplôme en la Visite de Aptitude de Dégustation.
Okay.
It's called the DUAD.
It's the last time we're going to say that. D-U-A-D, DUAD.
D-U-A-D,
okay,
the DUAD.
Okay, we'll refer to it as that.
The DUAD. It's a very famous program in France. You have to be a professional in the wine industry to apply and be accepted. They accept 40 people a year. The majority of people in the class are French because it is a program that is taught in French by the professors within the Oenology department at the University of Bordeaux. University of Bordeaux is the top university in France for winemaking and for oenology. And it was a compacted, tight program, and it's a brilliant program. It started with a research from a very famous professor called Penaud, who talked about if it's in the glass, how did it get there? So the wine study aspect was started from what was in the glass, the components, the terroir, the vinification, all aspects of how you get what gets into the glass and where does it come from. And so that was the overlying curriculum of the program.
Great.
It's very intense. There were 9, you know, tasting exams. There were 2 written exams. There was an oral exam.
Extensive.
And most foreigners don't pass the class.
And you did?
With honors.
You passed, came back to the States?
Correct.
How long of a period was the whole...
It was about, I think a little bit over about 18 months from start to scratch. I mean, the learning and then when you finished up with all your testing. And so I returned to the States in June, July of 2006.
Right.
That's where I started to do a lot of peer-to-peer and non-competitive work to support women in my industry. First thing I did is I brought over 11 women from Bordeaux to connect and share stories with women in Napa.
Nice.
And then brought about 15 women from Napa to Bordeaux. They're never seen anything like it from the Bordeaux Society, but they hosted probably about 60, 70 women hosted these 15 women. It was extraordinary.
Sure.
And the last year I had the energy to do this, I think there were 30 women from around the world. The only Turkish winemaker, a South African winemaker, the only Japanese winemaker, women from France. And they came and collaborated in a peer-to-peer 3-day program I put together with probably about 60, 70, 80 women in Napa.
Wow.
It was really profound.
Very profound.
Impactful.
So that is right before, because you mentioned earlier, you started Rare Cat in 08.
That's correct.
So you get the degree, you're doing some very cool stuff, and then you formally launch the winery in
08? That's right. I formally launched the winery in 2008. It had a very specific goal in mind. It was really to take that kind of American sensibility. I'm a California girl. But to combine with a French palate and French winemaking to really produce world-class wines from single vineyard sources and to focus on bringing and migrating to, I think, pretty important cultures or cultural influences to make wine.
You had your mission statement pretty clear going.
I think it's always mission statements change and adapt, but
well,
nonetheless.
You were in business, so you know you have to have a plan.
Yes.
We're going to talk about Rare Cat a little more extensively, but I wanted to get your take on a couple of things that
Absolutely.
You had mentioned. How do you think, it's a very general question, but how do you think women are doing in wine right now? And I guess the context is in management, in sales, in sommelier positions. You know, where are women at in wine in your mind today?
Well, women in the wine industry represent less than 10% of the industry, so
that
it's a
sucks,
small component.
Right?
I think it depends on what aspect of the industry we're talking about. If you're talking about Napa Valley winemakers, I think we can say that there's been profound influence from some extraordinary women in the wine industry making some of the most important wines in the world.
Do you think it's more than 10%? I mean, I know when you talk about you and Kathy Corris and Celia Welch, these are the best.
Yeah, the
but
best of the
are
best.
They 10% or are they still...
Gosh, I don't know the answer to
okay.
that.
I
feels
bet it's
like
not
it's
much
more.
More.
But it feels like
not
it's
enough.
More, but it's probably not enough.
Right.
You start to talk about
so they
vineyard
excel
manage-
in that, right.
Vineyard management. I can only think about two women in the vineyard management. When you talk about the distribution side, executives within distribution, it becomes almost dismal. Very often there are no women in the room there. On the psalm side, I think that there are, now we start to see more and more psalms. Are they at major positions? I think it's still very, it's a very small percentage of the overall, you know, psalm community.
I agree. I think yeah. in New York you see a little more growth.
Yeah.
Better, things are better, but we're not where we want to be.
No, I think my focus in the last 7 years has, I do a lot to try to support women in my industry, and I always have with a Wine Alta Femme and a Women's Palette. That's very important to me.
Those
to
are
be
organizations,
positive.
Right?
Organizations.
Right.
However, I think my personal focus has been working more with executive women within corporations and businesses, because what I know with confidence is that wine is an incredibly powerful tool in business, and when used purposely, it can change careers. And so my focus is, because of the skill set I have, being an executive, being a winemaker, being someone who loves to present and transfer information and compel people with stories, is I've been using those attributes to help educate women about how to use wine as a business tool. And that's more of my focus in the last 7 years. I've worked with just numerous large corporations across the board in many sectors and thousands of women. And that's where my passion is. I love using wine to empower women. But my key focus right now is not only on educating women, it's actually working with men in business who run companies who are trying to figure out how to elevate women within their companies and understanding...
That problem needs to be solved.
Yes, and understanding that if they want to be successful moving forward, they can be 40 to 65% more successful if they have diverse boards. So helping them with strategies to bridge those gender gaps. So my focus very often is actually more within a male audience within corporations and elevating and using wine as an educational process to bring women together within businesses. So it's not just one or the other.
Right. So you're committed to women's leadership, diversity, empowering,
yes.
convincing men.
Yes. I'm a great, I have an MBA. I'm an economics major.
Right.
I care about
you didn't
about
mention
the success.
That in
yeah.
your thing. I told you to be brief, but you had to be thorough.
But we know companies with diverse boards are 40 to 65% more successful. That's a fact.
Yes.
And so there's an economic reason why companies need to take a really profound look at this. And what I see is that they're searching for solutions. They're searching for bridging ways to bridge and elevate and support and mentor. And so they're looking for those sorts of programs, and I would like to be part of that solution.
So that kind of segues into what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
We're in New York because you packed up your Suburban.
Yes.
And you are in the midst of a 23-city tour.
That is correct.
Talking to different people at different places about
yes.
what you just said and
yes.
other things. So tell me, you know, about the tour and the objectives
yes.
and goals.
So a couple important things to know is that I don't like cars.
Okay.
I'm not particularly a great driver. I'm
All
a very
right.
distracted driver. So for me to get to rent a Suburban that I don't know how to back up and drive across the United States for 2.5 months to 23 cities, there has to be a compelling reason. And I believe wine is a tool to empower women. I believe wine is a tool.
It's a profound tool.
It's a profound.
Say it.
It's a profound tool.
Go
it's
ahead.
My favorite word.
Go
profound
ahead.
Tool
Go ahead.
To empower women and to promote diversity. But it's also a tool that potentially we can connect people. And I would also suggest that I didn't want to fly over anymore after this last past year. I wanted to bring people together for respectful conversation. And that was enough of a compelling reason to get me to drive a Suburban across the United States.
Great idea.
And that's what I'm doing. And I will tell you, this is my seventh city. I probably driven about 6,000 miles. I left March 27th. I will not get back home until June 6th. And nowhere have I been has the message not resonated, that people want to come together and they are tired of some of the discourse. I think people want to build community. Everywhere I've been, every political environment I've been in, people want to come together and they want to build community. My argument is that if they do that with Rare Cat on the Table, that they will be profoundly more successful, 10 times more successful in building community if they have Rare Cat on the table.
Well, let's break that down. Rare Cat is your wine. We know it's a terrific wine, but in a general term, are we talking about wine as a communal,
absolutely,
a lubricant, you know, social,
absolutely,
drink and all that?
Yeah, think
so
about
you're melding,
absolutely,
the circumstance,
yeah,
and wine to, yeah, really get people to,
absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, this is not a new concept. You know, the Romans and the Greeks used wine to build community. It's a concept that's existed for 5,000 years, breaking bread, sharing a glass of wine, bringing people to the table. I can see it. I see it within a corporate environment with people come in. I call them, they come in hot. Their body language, they're tight, they're aggressive, they're thinking about
that
business. And
right,
you give them one glass of sparkling and it all, they just, you can see it in their body language, this ability to relax. Wine is a lubricant. It's a social lubricant. Now, I mean, too much wine or too much of anything is,
right,
is not a good thing. So we're talking about just, you
right
know, responsible.
You're not a manager.
No.
That. Yeah.
But you see it and you see people relax and people tend to share and connect, build stories and build conversations when they're more relaxed. That's when creativity happens, when you're more relaxed. It's
yep
when relationships start. So absolutely, people are more open to conversations after a few glasses of wine.
I think it's a great thing.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little about the wines. Let's talk about Rare Cat. I'll set it up, but you really break it down for me. You make wines in Napa. You make wines in Bordeaux. You make wines in Champagne.
Yes.
I would say that's not your typical Napa wine company or Napa winemaker.
Yeah.
You talked a little earlier about, you know, your vision and the quality. Set up Rare Cat for me.
So there is no other American woman producing wines in Bordeaux and Champagne. So it is outside of the box thinking.
Very cool.
It's very innovative thinking. And we produce, we import, we, in essence, use maybe a technology model, but we eliminate four tiers of distribution. Our winery only sells direct to consumers through clubs, allocations, and mailing lists. So what do? We produce single vineyard wines in world-class regions. We produce wines in Napa Valley. It is, without a doubt, Napa Valley, to me, is the greatest place on the planet to produce Cabernet Sauvignon. I will bring my cab to Bordeaux and have these conversations with my friends who are analogs. I will tell you that I have never gotten anyone to agree with me on that in Bordeaux, but I get, c'est pas mal, which means it's really pretty darn great stuff.
They wouldn't tell you anyway.
They wouldn't anyway. I know no. When my friend served our Old Toll and set it up against a Chateau Palmer with three of his analog friends last year, the analogs liked my wines more than Chateau Palmer.
So Old Toll is your Cabernet Sauvignon,
it's our Cabernet
bottling.
Sauvignon from, yes.
It's predominantly or all Cab?
So it is a little bit of a Bordeaux influence to it. It is 89% Cabernet Sauvignon. It's 2% Petit Verdot. And it's the rest is about 9% Cab Franc. But every year that blend changes.
Right.
We start from scratch.
Right.
We now work with three hillside vineyards in Napa Valley and two valley floor vineyards. So we
good
grow
blend
fruit
of different types
correct
of grapes.
From vineyards that I've planted, from vineyards that I manage, and from vineyards that I buy grapes. So my philosophy is what matters most to me is what is in the bottle, and I will achieve that from any business model I need to do to get there. Because in Bordeaux and Champagne and Napa, there are different business models that one has to use in order to achieve your goals.
Right. And I don't know if we formally said it, but you are the winemaker.
Director of all winemaking.
So you're directing all the winemaking.
Yes.
So what's in the glass is your vision.
Yeah.
So
I actually care deeply about it.
I'm sure.
I try not to talk about tannins, but I actually care deeply about
well,
what's in the bottle.
That's a whole different conversation.
Yes.
So you have the Cabernet Sauvignon.
Correct.
Have in front of me, you were gracious enough to bring some wines. You're promoting a rosé.
That's correct.
Very good timing.
Thank you.
Tell me quickly about the rosé.
We've been making it for many years. It is a French-style, Provence-style rosé. It is made from scratch to be a rosé. If you want to make something great, you have to do it with purpose. This is a Grenache rosé, 90%,
nice.
10% Viognier, which brings a little bit of unctuousness to that middle palate. To me, when I think about world-class great rosés, I think about beautiful aromatics, slight texture in the mouth, but not heavy, and then, of course, bone dry, so it's refreshing. So the key to this wine, it's a very easy wine to make. It's 5 months, but you can't hide your mistakes. So you actually have to be thoughtful in everything you do.
Less in rosé, you can't hide your mistakes?
You can't.
I mean,
it's
pretty pure
and,
that
and
way.
And it really is about being, it's about the pick date. It's about low sugars. It's about high acidities. It's about very soft press. It's about color extraction and management. It's about cold fermentation and stainless steel tanks. Like, all those things matter a lot because you're getting to make this very quickly relative to a four-year cab.
Right.
And so I am thrilled with this. The 2017, I think it has a really beautiful, bright color. I think the aromatics are just spot on. It's a single vineyard that we've been working for many, many years now.
I tasted it and I agree.
Thank you.
I will endorse that. When we're done, we'll talk about how, where you can get more info on the wines and all of that.
Because we are in New York. We're rosé all day.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
Which we'll tell people what that is.
Okay.
I think it's the second year.
Okay.
All right, so let's talk about your two other wines. You, like you said, you make a Bordeaux in...
Yes, I make a
Saint-Emilion. I think you did that so you could buy a house?
Yes. Well, I bought the house, and then it is 100 yards from my house.
Okay.
And I do wine tourism to Saint-Emilion and Bordeaux. But this is a dream come true because this is where I really fell in love with the Bordeaux region when I was 20 in Saint-Emilion. It's, to me, the most beautiful village in France, or arguably one of them, first UNESCO World Heritage Site. All of the great Saint-Emilion wines come from the Plateau de Calcaire, meaning they have limestone subsoils. It's very tight. It's a very cold soil type. So these vines are 30 years old, slightly sloping on the northeastern side of Saint-Emilion in a sector called Sector Ville-Marine. So Ville-Marine, Cuspa, Trompe-la-Mendeau, Trompe-en-Vieille are all within this side. Got a concentration of extraordinary quality. Vines are very low to the ground. They're 30 years old. You need the radiated heat to help, you know, the maturity of those grapes. It is all hand harvested. It is almost gigantic. We use mold control in the vineyards. And the fruit gets picked by hand and brought down to my partner's property in Pomerol, where it goes through pretty classic terroir yeast. So you have extraction methods and you have kind of usually vineyard forward methods. And
right.
So we use... cold maceration 2-3 days. It goes into cement tank, goes through alcoholic fermentation, goes into barrel for malolactic fermentation. 50% new French oak sits in barrel for about 18 months. We do our final blends, bottle age for a year. And so this vintage is our 2014 vintage. It's our fourth vintage from the vineyard. This one here.
All right, I'm going to take a little sip.
Try one. And this is a wine, I call this a wine like my oldest son. It's a very introverted wine. It's a very shy wine. But when it opens up, it is so beautiful, profoundly beautiful.
It's delicious.
But like a lot of great young French wines, it needs to be decanted. There's a respectfulness of how you serve this wine. And so I talk a lot about that. If you love Bordeaux, there's work that you have to do. It's
to
not
appreciate
as,
it at its yeah, best.
Absolutely.
So you're saying a Bordeaux like this, a young one, you want to decant
absolutely.
For about how long?
Open in the morning, drink at night. Open in the morning, drink that night.
Literally
next night, next
sit
night.
Around open all day.
Absolutely.
That much time to
in fact,
open.
I do a lot of fun trials, blind tastings, where I'll put this one directly open next to a wine that's been open, same wine for
same
3 days.
Same wine.
Love the 3 days. It's just such a young wine still.
So that's a good lesson from a pro. Don't be afraid to open your wines, decant them, and let them sit out.
And so this is a great wine. We talk about portion control for women or people who want to open a bottle or they're at home and they just want to have a glass over a couple nights. This is an amazing wine. You can open it up and drink it a glass, first night, second night, third night, and you'll be absolutely delighted by the progression of this wine.
Nice.
Great food.
Tell me
too.
About, it's rare I sit with somebody who makes a Napa Cab, a Saint-Emilion, and you make a Blanc de Blanc Champagne,
I
right?
I do. I
How
make
did
a
that come
champagne.
About?
Delusional thinking and outside okay, of the box thinking. You know, one could argue after 36 years in and out of Bordeaux and studying wines, I have friends from when I was 20, the connections to be able to do something in Bordeaux makes sense. I speak the language, I studied there. There's a level of respectfulness that I have. I've got connections. To say, as a California girl, I want to make a world-class champagne, that's potentially delusional. But it was
Follow
a friend
your
of
delusions.
Mine. Absolutely. That's where innovation comes. If you can think it, you can do it. And thank goodness I have a creative brain. It was a friend of mine. So this family is the oldest family in Champagne.
Tell everyone who it is.
Michel Gonet.
G-O-N-E-T.
They have been continually producing wines for 500 years. They have 40 hectares of some of the best vineyards in Champagne. I have the honor of working with the ninth generation to produce a rare cat wine out of their facility in Azy.
Wow.
My focus on the Blanc de Blanc is a vineyard in the Côte de Cézanne region, which is farther south. It is a Blanc de Blanc, 100% Chardonnay. The first vintage that we did was a 2009, on yeast 7 years, late degorged, single vineyard, grower champagne. So that plays pretty
nice.
High.
Grower champagne's the hottest thing right now.
Yeah. And so as it turns out, I have none of it left. My next vintage is 2014.
What kind of bottlings you did?
We do 600 to 800 cases of it, okay. Basically. But when I was in Hartford, Connecticut a week ago, some of my great clients actually re-gifted me 2 bottles. So I'm going to be drinking those 2 bottles tonight in New York at the Musket Room with some dear friends. So I am over the moon.
That'll
ecstatic.
Be great.
Yeah.
That'll be great.
So our next vintage is 2014. It'll degorge in July of this year because of the 3-year requirement for a vintage. And we'll see it here in the fall. I also do another sparkling wine, which I'm really...
A Cremant
de Bordeaux. And it's delightful. It's because it's one of the few Cremants. It's 100% Sémillon. And it has just... It is absolutely delightful. I call it my book club bubbles, my casual bubbles, my rooftop bubbles, my beach bubbles.
Fun drink that's delicious
fun,
and not
delicious,
expensive.
Clean, not expensive, but clean, clean, clean. Beautiful aromatics, clean in the mouth, bright, beautiful acidity. A really pretty, appetizer, antipasto wine. Mm. I mean, it's just that kind of, that cocktail, sit around, drink every day, perfect,
nice.
Sparkling.
So that's Rare Cat Cremant?
Yes. We call it a Rare Cat French Sparkling because not very many people know Cremant de Bordeaux.
Right.
But it is a AOC.
They know
Cremant,
but not from Bordeaux.
That's right. It's not.
All right. So you have all these terrific wines. If describing them hasn't piqued people's interest, I don't know what will. How do we find out more? Because we have to wrap up. How do we find out more about the wines and where to get them, try them? You have a few mechanisms in place where you talk to me about that.
So we are a very small winery. We only sell direct through clubs allocations. So the best way to get our wines and be part of our community and journey and get access to getting allocations is to join one of our allocations or one of our clubs on the website.
Which is, what's the address?
Rare Cat Wines, that's RareCatWines.com, RareCatWines.com. We have 2 of our wines that are available for sale on a store on the website. We have been very lucky to see 100% growth and really some pretty beautiful growth, not last, but the years before. A lot of our clients who are engaged and love our story and love our wines have been kind enough, and that's what I'm doing, 47 events across the United States, hosting us on private wine events. So that's another great way. If I'm in a city and there's access to, you know, getting to one of those events, that's great too.
Do you post events and
only
stuff on the site?
Only if they're open to
right.
my clients. Yeah.
So if anybody can access something, you would post that
that's
event.
That's right. I will say, like, we're doing an open event in Washington, D.C. at Lost and Found, but it's sold out.
Right.
We've been a really... And our,
well, you have your 23 tour dates on the site?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. Now, like we said, not everyone is open, but if you want to know
and
about...
And they can follow me, too. The best way is on
let's
Instagram.
Let's talk social.
Because I've found I've not been a social media maven, but now I'm finding
what's
people...
What's your Instagram address?
At Rare Cat Wines.
Okay. And
yes.
Are you on Twitter or Facebook?
Yes, both the same,
okay.
At Rare Cat Wines. Yes.
All right, Sharon, we have to wrap up.
I don't want to go, though.
You have to. I told you it'd go quickly.
I think I want to come back. Can I come back?
You can. I would love to have you back. We have to take a break. I want to thank Sharon Harris from Rare Cat Wines. When we come back, we'll talk to Beth Von Benz. It's no secret that I like being that person who always has some great wine on hand. When I know I've got a few bottles hanging around the kitchen, I feel like I'm ready for anything. If anything is just because I never know when friends will drop by unannounced, or because it's even just a Monday. I also hate that last minute run to the store. Wine was never meant to be bought in a hurry. It's funny how we have so much patience growing the grapes, aging the wine, only to feel pressured when you're staring at the shelf. I use Vivino to scan and keep track of my favorites. But lately, I've been stocking up through their web store. They have the best prices and largest online wine inventory, but can also give you personalized recommendations based on bottles you've liked in the past. And I use their premium service for unlimited free shipping. That's an extra bottle's worth of savings on every order. Plus, they have a 30-day free trial. I just grab a few at a time and save them from when the right moment rolls around. You never know when that'll be. Visit vivino.com/grapenation to stock up. Didn't you see? Welcome to the show, Beth, and thank you for joining us for our Women in Wine Month in June.
Thanks for having me.
Beth. You've traveled the world. You've held many positions and worked with some great wine people in New York City. I'm not going to date you, but during the 80s, 90s, and now, we're way into the early 2000s. What I want to get from you, just to start with, is that moment when you realized your love for wine, and basically that's what you were going to be doing from that point on. And if you can weave in a chronology for me to the best you can. I know that it could take a long time, but give it your best shot.
All righty. Well, I was born in Boston. My parents had a summer house on Cape Cod, and nice. One of my first jobs was working in restaurants in Provincetown. So in the late teens, at an early age, I worked at some fine-ish dining restaurants. So I started out knowing about the business, but at that point in time, there wasn't a lot of wine. I moved to Boston, I moved to San Francisco, I moved to Los Angeles, I moved back to the East Coast and came back to New York and decided that's where I was staying. All of those places, I did work occasionally in restaurants, and some of them were also fine dining. I had an aunt when I lived in San Francisco who lived in Sonoma, and she took me to Chez Panisse. She took me to the Zuni Cafe. So all of these times, I worked with somebody who lived across from the old Spago in L.A., and we used to go in there and drink cocktails. But really, none of this was wine, but I did have some fine dining. So I come to New York. I work in some restaurants. It gets to be a few years later, and I decided I've never traveled anywhere. So I give up everything. I put all my things into storage and I go to Europe first for the 6 months. Then I come back. I work in restaurants, and one of them was Cafe Luxembourg, which was one of the first
upper west taste.
A woman. Wait,
give us a year so we know where
this
we're.
This was late '80s.
Okay, so we're in the late '80s.
Okay, right. And so a fantastic woman named Diana von Furstenberg. Diana von Van Buren. I know. No, Diana Van Buren. She was the pastry chef. She was also then later known for Bar Six, that was in the West Village, a fantastic wine program. She did a lot of traveling. She did the wine list at Café Luxembourg. It was a very hip, fun place, and I learned a lot from her. Fast forward, I traveled for a few years.
A woman in wine.
A woman in wine, exactly.
Cool.
Inspired by a woman in wine, absolutely. Yeah. That was kind of cool, because in those days, there wasn't the wine person. The pastry chef was the wine person.
Right.
So that was very neat. And then I traveled to Asia. I met my husband in Australia.
Is he Australian?
Yes, he is. Okay. And we tasted a lot of wine there. Then we went to Greece together, and that was the first time I had ever traveled around Greece, tasted some wines, but still... 1990, not the best wines in Greece, but, you know, I'm seeing the pairing, the food pairing, the whole thing that comes when you travel.
Did you go to Greece because it's a beautiful place to visit?
Yes.
And the wines, or no, the wines were sort of secondary?
Everything, the wine to this point, even though I'm in fine dining, just wasn't the thing for
Got
me.
It.
So I moved to, my husband moves to New York. We work for a while. We do the same thing. We save up money. We go to Mexico and Guatemala for a year. We were married by the mayor in Antigua, Guatemala. We come back and we work at a nightclub in the 50s called Tattoo. And a friend of mine did the wine program there. And at this point, all this traveling I've been doing, a lot of my friends who were bartenders, managers, waiters, they're all now in the wine business. They're salesmen or brand managers or buying wine. So I have all these connections. So we start tasting wine at Tattoo. I know this friend of mine who worked there, Carl Intersano. He is, we used to work at Cherry Lehman. So we're all into the wine, but we're still kind of waiters, bartenders, managers. Then I leave there and I go down to this really cute lounge bar in the East Village, more downtown, more my style, because I'm living in the East Village now also and have been the whole time. And it's called Global 33. So I worked there for a while. Dewey Dufresne from Fabulous Biggie Sandwiches, he was the consulting chef there, and it was really cool, fantastic place. And they said, you should buy the wines, which consisted of 10 whites and 10 reds. But it gave me a chance.
That's what they had, or that's what they wanted you to buy?
No, that's what I bought.
Okay.
But then all my friends would come in and invite me out to lunches and to tastings, and, you know, this opened the gates. I took classes.
So the global thing was kind of a breakthrough
absolutely.
For exposure.
Absolutely. And
you were loving it?
Absolutely. And I took classes. I went to the ASA. Andrea Immer was around at Windows, this before, but she was a big person also that, you know, I remember in the Post, in like 1994, they did an article on women in wine. Andrea Immer and I, and I think maybe Karen King, were like the three people that would featured, and that was a big deal for me.
Wow.
So I'm at Global 33, and a friend of mine comes in, and she said, you should go uptown to this place. There's a fabulous chef that just left Gotham Bar and Grill. He was Alfred Pertoli's sous chef, Bill Telepin. So
the
he had this...
Telepin.
Yes, absolutely. The great Bill Telepin. He had this restaurant that no one has ever heard of, because I think it lasted like maybe a year, and it was called Ansonia. Upper West Side. Very difficult restaurant wasteland, you know, really a tough place to make a foundation of
Much better now.
It's a little,
better, but it's not like it blew up.
A little bit better.
Yeah.
So that was my first restaurant. That was my first heirloom tomato or anything farm to table. You know, I probably never had at that point gone to Gotham before. This was, you know, out of my realm a little bit, and I had to run to catch up. There were tasting menus and unusual food. A lot of people came in to check it out. There's a lot of connections. So that was my first job. Then one day I went and the door was locked with a, you know, your clothes.
Okay. That's bad.
And I worked at two wine stores because it was the fall. I worked at Gotham Wines Uptown, which was a different location, but it actually had bulletproof cashiers. And then I opened with Chris Cree, who's an MW Fabulous, Chelsea Wine Vault.
Oh, that's
so
a cool place.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, one, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, the other, completely different. But I got a real immersion in what was happening, what was selling retail. I made $9 an hour. It was crazy, but it was fun. Then I went from there to Estetoria Milos, and that's really my Greek breakthrough. This is 1997.
But Estetoria is a big deal because it's a big deal restaurant.
Absolutely. It was then.
Greek, right.
Absolutely.
It hit the ground as a spot.
Absolutely.
So you get there, what year you said?
97.
Okay.
So I worked there and I try to put together a list. Now, Roger Dargon previously did the list a year before, the opening
list. As a consultant?
Yes. And he was told no Greek wines. A year later, they wanted all Greek wines, which was difficult to find because I had to like call people up, go to Astoria. You know, there was no 750.
Right.
There was like the beverage media and nothing
was
in there.
Distributors, I assume, too.
Absolutely. But they were all individual.
Right.
So
this guy had three, that guy had three.
That's the thing, like Italian wines in those days.
No way evolved in the market the way it is now.
Absolutely.
Right? So you had to really dig for it.
Absolutely. And there was no one there to help me because no other restaurant except Greek restaurants had it. So I worked there. I compiled a list of 50 Greek wines plus, 200 wines, but that was a really big deal. And I introduced Greek wines to a lot of sommeliers around town. People called me up and said, hey, from Ducasse or from Paul at Gramercy or Karen at Union Square. And I brought Greek wines to non-Greek restaurants.
So take pause for a second. You go to this restaurant, which eventually becomes one of the great restaurants, let alone Greek restaurants in New York, and they finally ask you to buy Greek wines. Now, you did it because they asked you, but obviously, like you said, you had to dig and taste. Mm-hmm. What were you thinking? I mean, how were the wines, the quality? I mean, what was your take then?
To tell you the truth, I was very excited about it, but actually, when I look back, I did have a lot of European varietals and not indigenous Greek grapes because that just was the supply and demand. That was here. So I did have Sauvignon Blanc and a Chardonnay and a few things like that, or blends.
But by Greek makers?
By Greek makers. Absolutely.
And they were growing the Chard and the Sauvignon Blanc.
Yes, and there were other grapes too.
Right.
And, I was around when, I poured this wine, lots of wines by the glass
right.
that now are prohibitive at that cost.
Right. So you're at Milos. You break into the whole Greek thing. You become sort of this Greek expert.
Absolutely.
So then what happened?
2 years later, I'm out with Chris Cannon at a wine dinner. And I just met him, famous restaurateur,
Jockey
Hall,
guy, right?
Amazing man.
Right.
And I said, I think I'm leaving Milos. And he said, you have to come to Judson Grill. And now Bill Telepan had relocated. He was a 3-star New York Times chef at Judson Grill. And I went there.
In the mid-50s, midtown.
Absolutely. And a lot of people said, well, you're going to be working with Chris, and it's not really going to be your baby. But Chris told me eventually he was possibly going to move on, which he did. But it was the smartest thing, because it gets lonely
right.
working by yourself. Those days, there weren't any assistants. You'd be like, how's this wine? Oh, I'm only by myself. So it was fun, and I learned so much from Chris, because he had come from a bunch of Italian restaurants, and that's something that was really my weak spot. And I learned how to run a business, how to, buy wines, how to just do everything in a wine program. He set me up completely.
Now, so Chris was working for Bill?
He was a managing partner.
He was a managing partner.
Yeah, he
had some equity or
absolutely.
Something?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. But he was on the floor and he knew. And, it was a big place. That place was a monster.
Yes.
We did a lot of parties. We did a huge power lunch. So this was, and we had a very eclectic wine list.
Explain a little. What
we had he had a page. The first page was a value page, and we put on all sorts of things. So his parents live in Athens, and his mother's Greek. So he loved the Greek wines, and this is a point where no one had Greek wines. So I just brought over
Perfect.
A whole bunch of Greek wines, and I had like wines from Slovenia. I had a whole page of like rosés when nobody had rosé. But on this value page, people were like, "Oh, okay, I'm going to take a chance because it's a value." So we really moved, absolutely,
right.
We moved a lot on that page, and it was really exciting to use that as a vehicle.
But you had all the fine wine stuff, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the Calis
we had DRC
and
the Super Tuscan, absolutely, everything.
So you're there how long? You're working with Chris, which turned out, crazy guy, but turned out to be a great experience.
Absolutely.
For you.
And he left. I was there for 4 years.
Wow.
Right. So, that's a lot. And 2004, then I left there. and I went out to the Nick and Tony's out in the Hamptons,
right.
And I worked there for a little while, and then I, losing my mind, I went to Guastavino's. So Michael LaMonaco.
Explain to people what Guastavino's
is.
Interesting
is that big,
place in
fabulous
space.
Place over on the east side that's right under the Roosevelt Island tram. And Michael LaMonaco was working for David Emile and doing a little pop-up, which is hilarious to think of, but basically he was doing a consultant job, and he was working towards Porterhouse, New York, which I then became the wine director in the Time Warner building.
So Michael's still at Porterhouse.
Yes, he is.
One of the better great steakhouses
Absolutely.
In New York. Michael's
Absolutely.
A wonderful guy.
Absolutely. Lovely
but
man.
It's steakhouse.
I know.
That's like a steakhouse wine
I
list.
I know.
How do you work that? Are you stuck or you could do things?
Well, I was like the guru of like Slovenian geeky wine. So when I was approached, I was like, okay, this is cool. But I had some time. I went out to a lot of steakhouses. I realized that it's about like a simple technique, that this is spa for men. They go there. They already probably know what they're going to have to eat. They want to quickly find a wine. And the faster you find a wine for them, the more they're going to drink two bottles or three bottles. So I set up the whole wine list. I custom made it. I started small at first, and then I built. And really, it was a hugely successful program,
so you
wine
you
program.
You accepted what the challenge
Absolutely.
Is, what the market
Absolutely.
Was.
Absolutely. And people
and
would come in
it.
And like diss me. Because,
why?
Because they were like, this is your list? And I'm like, yes. Do you know how much wine we sold this month?
Wow.
So, but it, you know, it was a very interesting experience and a fantastic place to work and a
yeah.
great staff. And we put together a great group of psalms with me. And really, it was.
Now, Michael LaMonaco is the owner and the chef. Tell everyone where Michael made his name.
At Windows of the World.
Right. I mean, he was there before, during,
Absolutely.
And after the whole
Absolutely.
9/11 thing.
Absolutely.
So you stay at Porterhouse.
2 years.
2 years.
And then I wanted to take some time off, and a friend of mine worked up at Zaki's, and he said, why don't you just come up? And I said, well, I'm going to go to Mexico and do this. And I got up there, and they're like, there's your desk, and here's your... And I was like, did I miss the first two interviews? I'm not really sure. So I ended up being the American wine buyer and the 10 Greek wine buyer for Zaki's, which was a big job.
I was just going to say, I would think Zaki's moves as much
yeah,
California,
huge.
Washington,
it was huge.
Oregon,
it was huge.
You know, as anybody. What could you do there? I mean, were there like new wineries you could bring in?
Absolutely.
You know, what impact did you have there?
I had a lot of friends who were making wine in California, and I went to California a lot, and I helped support those wines, and I got into the job, and it was so great, and I love the people I work with, and then it became 2008.
Boom.
Yep. Scarsdale closed.
Nobody's buying anything.
So I left there, and I did some consulting, and I realized, you know, that's my thing. And so I have my own consulting firm, and I...
MVB Consulting.
MVB Consulting, absolutely. And I have since then worked with the Greek wines, and I now...
So you're one of the New York Greek wine experts.
Absolutely.
If not the country.
Absolutely.
What? So explain what the consulting thing is. You work with different restaurants, clients?
Right.
What
I have
type
a,
of stuff
I work
you're
at
doing?
A restaurant in the West Village. I buy for there part-time. It's called 50. 50, it used to be Commerce, 50 Commerce Street. And the chef is Ecuadorian, so I have real fun. And we're changing the list over to more South American wines, so I definitely...
Like Milos, buy me Greek wines.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Buy me
absolutely, which is
South
really
American.
Fun, because there's a lot of great stuff coming out of Chile and Argentina.
Well, let's talk about
and Uruguay.
That, because you're on it. So give me, drop some knowledge here. So people think of South America as... Argentina, Mendoza, and Chile.
Right.
Those are two major places.
Absolutely.
Are there any other areas
sure.
we should be
Sure. Brazil,
talking?
Uruguay is making some great Tanat from Uruguay.
Right.
And Paul Hobbs, I just tried a whole line of his Tanats from
Tanat
Uruguay.
Tanat is a red wine, very deep, brooding,
Absolutely.
Dark.
Absolutely.
Right?
And just as Malbec does really well in Argentina, Tanat does really well in Uruguay. So, I mean, that's kind of a cool
Right.
Cool
it's
wine.
Indigenous to the area.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of cool guys doing fantastic stuff. I was in Chile and Patagonia last year, and there's lots of fantastic biodynamics.
Pinots down there, right?
Pinots, unbelievable Pinots. Zorzal, Z-A...
Is that a maker?
Yes.
Z-O-R-Z-A-L?
Yes. And he makes Pinot Noir from Mendoza, but a little Tupungata area.
Tupungata,
that's,
right.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Give me another... About a Chilean?
Chilean Labertino.
Spell for me.
Labertino, Sauvignon Blanc. And he does a lot of white blends of like crazy blends, but really cool. And a lot of these guys have been picked up by producers that, I mean, distributors that people can find now, and they're really out there.
And I'm guessing they're not too crazy on price.
No, they're not.
Malbec's been a great value wine. I mean, there's higher end versions.
Absolutely.
What else?
I went to this really cool tasting the other day, and it was called the Descorchados Tasting, and it's a book that reviews wines from South America, and there was like amazing wines from this tasting, but that's where I tried the Labertino and the Zorzal.
Nice.
Absolutely.
All right, so we're current as far as your life, right?
Right.
You know, you're consulting, you're working
right.
at 50. So you were an early proponent, evangelist, cheerleader, exposer of Greek wines. Mm-hmm. You mentioned rosé, things like Gruner that you didn't talk about that nobody was pouring
right.
or drinking
right.
then, and probably a bunch of other familiar wines. I asked you this before the show. What, and you may have mentioned a few just now from South America, what are some of those wines now that are not recognized or, you know, not big? Certainly, Greek wines
Absolutely.
Were not a thing. Is it?
You know what's really crazy is now I'm running into Australian wines.
Coming back.
Unbelievable.
But a different presentation.
Absolutely. Now, it is true that a friend of mine just became the educator for Wines of Australia.
Okay.
But I was invited to this tasting the other day of 16 Aussie Pinots. And I was, like, incredibly impressed.
All
I mean, really.
Stuff.
But a lot of cool climate areas
yes.
making, not trying to make Burgundian wines,
right.
but with finesse and elegance. So,
do you remember a
yeah,
maker
I
or
do.
Two?
I do. There's one that's called Ochota, but actually...
Ochota Barrels.
Yes.
Yes. O-C-H-O-T-A?
Barrels,
okay.
absolutely. And it's called A Forest. Because he feels like there's like forestry notes in it. That's from Adelaide Hills. Fantastic
right.
wine. And another, Bindi Dixon, B-I-N-D-I, Dixon. And that's from the Macedon Mountain Ranges and the lower Macedon Mountain Ranges. So these are like beautiful, elegant, lovely, maybe like New Zealand Pinots way back
right.
when that were really very cool wines that I tasted, two wines.
So I think you're on to something because Australia had its day with Shiraz.
Absolutely.
But then it kind of went away, and now it's coming back in a different way.
Absolutely.
With these
was killed
cooler,
by Yellowtail.
Yeah. That'll kill anyone. but these cooler weather Pinots are making
Absolutely.
Cooler climate. They're making
Absolutely.
Rieslings and all that.
Absolutely.
What else? You got another one for me?
Yeah, I do. I really like Chocolate. I'm like back into Chocoli.
You have to spell that for everyone.
T-X-A-K-O-L-I.
Chocoli is the grape?
The Chocoli is kind of like the name of the wine.
The name of the
yes,
wine.
Yes, and Hondarabi Zuri. So H-O-N-D-A-R-R.
Is the grape?
And then Z-U-R-Y. Z-U-R-I is the grape.
And that's
so
from?
It's from Chocolate. It's up in the north in the Basque Country.
Right.
Really interesting wines. And they had their day too, but I just tried something that won the other day that was like absolutely fantastic. So
I think, you know, Psalms love it and it makes for an interesting wine list.
Absolutely.
You can come across it.
Absolutely.
I think the fact that you recommended it, we spelled it for people. When they see that crazy thing, they go, hey, that's the thing Beth was talking about. You know, so that's definitely a good one. So what's exciting you now? I mean, are those the wines that you've been trying? Is there any one thing that you've been drinking or you've come across? Is it the Australian wines?
No, white Bordeaux.
White Bordeaux.
I'm really into white Bordeaux.
Great value.
Some are great value and a lot, you know, less expensive and higher quality than I think. And you can find them around now. I mean, I'm very interested in like Grave Blanc. I love Grave Rouge, but I think there's a lot of value and interesting wines that are out there and cropping up everywhere.
That's a great reco. Sort of a selfless plug. In about 3 weeks, we're having three women winemakers that make white Bordeaux.
Oh, fantastic.
They're going to be on, pretty well known. So that's a good one. All right. So I'm going to list a lot of that stuff on our social media
great.
Sites because they're great recommendations. And, you know, that's why I wanted you to come in to talk about those wines and, you know, why you know about them. What I want to talk to you about, and we didn't talk about it while you were describing your career, in June we do Women in Wine. We try to feature wine and women. I'm just curious if you recall, recounted, felt that when you were in the business, and you were in the business at a time when, and I said it in the intro, being a somm was not a thing. It's a thing now. Was being a woman ever an issue?
I think there were times. It was interesting because when I went to Milos, which I thought were much more worldly clientele, there's a lot of celebrities, but I think that because people were European, that they're used to like the male bartender, you know, so that was
different
a little
culture.
Bit. Absolutely. But then when I went to Judson Grill, everyone was like perfectly fine with it. And, you know, I did have times where the person would say, can you send over the sommelier? But I mean, I think people have times like that now. I feel like I was really lucky. I also came on it a little bit later in life. So I wasn't like very, very young. So that's hard to be
you
young.
You were well traveled and mature
absolutely.
Enough.
No one was going to ask for the sommelier. They're afraid.
I guess you're the sommelier.
Well, I actually had an assistant when I was at Porterhouse, and he was very young, and he would go over to the table and they'd be like, where's Beth? Get out of here, kid. because he was, you know,
even
young.
In the early days, it wasn't, you know, even working, you know, in and out of restaurants and the bars and all
I
that.
I feel it like it gave me an advantage in a lot of ways.
I think it's your personality, too, and how you approach things. You know, it's an individual thing, too. How do you think women are doing in wine today?
I think they're doing great, you know.
And what do you say to support that? They have the jobs, they have the clout. I mean, what do you think?
I don't understand the question.
Well, I mean, is the presence of women in wine as good now, you know, as ever? I mean, are they holding positions, whether it's in restaurants, sommelier, management? Do you feel women have made their mark in wine?
I think so, but I think it's sometimes difficult now because it sometimes needs to depend on being attached to two little letters after your name. So in the last few years, I've gone out to Pebble Beach many years, as a matter of fact, and worked. And some of the panels are all men, and actually people were joking that they're mannels because, you know, so that's difficult. But then what is it, you know, it's very difficult to have experts in that field, and what you, the pool you have to choose from happens to be all men. So that's tough.
Well, I guess one of the things, you know, that points towards that is, if you look at MWs and even sommeliers, most of them are men, you know, so that has to continue to change. I think it is. I think in New York, you see more women sommeliers, more managers and all
that. And San Francisco and Los Angeles also. So.
But I think the rest of the country and certain, you know, businesses, you know, need to change.
When I sold wines at Zaki's, it was a lot of telephone. So someone would do a big order and you would call up. And I would look through the list and the entire list was all men. And when I'd see a woman, I would get so excited and like email her. And she would come to find out that she was the secretary of the law firm buying the wine through for her boss. And it was like, damn.
Well, you know, you kind of answered my question because when you look at wine and who's consuming it, and Zaki's is top of the game as far as retail and what they have access to and what they sell, it's mostly guys.
Absolutely.
You know, I think that's changed a little. I think, you know, women are probably buying as much or more wine than ever. But if you look at the Zaki's list, you know, it's still a bunch of dudes or
whatever. It was shocking.
Yeah. And I don't know how much different it is now. If you look back, I mean, you've been doing this probably over 25 years. I mean, if you had to think about what's changed the most, you know, anyway, currently than, you know, when you started coming through it, what changes have you seen?
I think the incredible, like, availability and the broad range of knowledge of somms and the upgrade of so many restaurants are bringing in a wine person. They have a manager, a wine person, the chefs, and it's just wonderful to have that. I think that that is fantastic. And just, you know...
It's taking a center stage.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's and it's so easy to...
knowledge, availability.
5 years ago, I had a friend who wrote for Real Simple Magazine, and she would ask me to pair the wines with the food. And at that point, just like the internet really hadn't taken off too much, so they would say, you have to have a wine that's available in 30 states. And then you know, that it down to like Ravenswood Zinfandel.
Right. Right.
So now things have really changed. So when I do something for a magazine, they never ask me that because I do things for Wines Rioja.
Right. That's why when I ask our guests for wines, you know, talk to me about things that are accessible, somewhat accessible.
Absolutely.
You know, accessibility can be in a restaurant, could be restaurant and retail,
right.
could
right.
be retail.
Right.
And price. You know, not everybody's going to drop 70, 80, 100
Absolutely.
On wine.
I'm a cheapskate when it comes to wines.
Well, I think the other thing is, and you're probably as good as anyone, you could find incredible value.
I love to do that.
And I'm going to ask you in our
Absolutely.
Wine list.
Absolutely.
So one of the big takeaways is availability,
Absolutely. Yeah.
accessibility,
yeah.
more stuff and all of that. I agree with that. I had Kevin Zraley on almost a year ago, and he said, I worked in New York. There were 5 Psalms in the city.
Absolutely.
He said you go to 11 Madison, there's 6 on the floor.
I know.
You know, so there's that whole change in everything, which is interesting. All right, Beth, I want to subject you to our wine list. I want you to talk about your preferences. I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions and, you know, just buzz through them. You don't have to overthink these. They're simple questions. We ask our guests the same questions. So the first question is, and maybe you answered it, but tie it together for me, is what are you drinking now? What's on your table at home? What are you tasting? Is it seasonal?
Yeah, seasonal rosé. You know, I really like rosé. I just had a Muga Rioja rosé, which is delicious, 2017.
M-U-G-A,
fresh,
Spanish.
M-U-G-A Rioja, and it was like $14.
So $14,
yeah,
I was just going to say.
Yeah.
So that's a great value.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
Rosés, anything else?
Yeah. No, I guess so. But probably Bordeaux Blanc, Chocolat.
Right, right. You know, I said
I
we
love sparkling wines, but I don't even want to mention the C word because everybody's
well,
so
then,
into
then,
it.
Then great. So there's champagne. Give me a couple of sparkling wines or regions.
Okay.
You know, that
know
you like. Is it Jura? Is it Cremant?
Cremant Alsace. Cremant Alsace.
Right.
Fantastic. You know, I'm doing a whole Alsace retail thing this month. Alsace Rocks.
There you go.
For two in, for wines of Alsace. And I've been tasting some really delicious, made in the same way as champagne.
Right.
But under $20, almost
all of them.
You
remember anybody?
Well, I do have one, but it's a little bit more expensive.
Yeah, but it's cheaper than champagne.
Right. It's Valentin Zusslin.
V-A-L-E-N-T-I-N.
Right. And Z-U-S-S-L-I-N.
And that's
and
Alsatian?
Alsatian. Cremant
sparkling
Alsace.
Cremant.
Brut zero. No sulfites and no dosage. So very dry, elegant. So that's in the upper 20s.
Okay.
That's but
not,
really delicious.
That's not bad.
You know, still, it's you know, much less than
yes.
champagne.
Yes. All right, so those are good ones. We'll move along. Does Beth have her favorite wine and food pairing? Anything that
I love
comes
all
back?
Sorts of things, but lately I just seem
few.
To be going through. Last night I went to a white Bordeaux, see fresh on my mind, tasting at Waverly Inn, and I had the most divine, simple deviled egg.
With a white Bordeaux?
White Bordeaux, Chateau du Maine, M-A-Y-N-E, Grave Blanc, but on the richer style, like 75%
So tell me
semillon.
Why that works. The egg is rich, the yolk, you have the protein
Absolutely.
From
and
the white.
And a lot of times they say, you know, eggs coat the mouth, so, but whatever. But this wine, it was just creamy and creamy. So complement, you know, there can be contrast and complement. But I just loved it. It was just such a delicious little, and so simple. Deviled eggs.
Listen,
white Bordeaux.
That's a first for the show. Nobody has ever. Some people have said champagne and oysters.
Right,
more
I know.
Nobody
I
said
know.
Deviled eggs
I know.
And white Bordeaux.
Definitely.
So kudos to you
Thank
on that.
Thank you very much.
All right. You certainly have been around, so I want you to tell me your favorite wine, restaurant, and or bar. Could be New York, could be anywhere. But places that do wine well, are passionate about it, have the selection, the knowledge.
Restaurant, wine bar, both, either?
Well, restaurant, and I also have a wine bar. Restaurant would be Molivos. I think that Kamal is doing a fantastic job, the wine director of Molivos. He has, like, undoubtedly the best Greek wine list in the world.
Even so, Molivos, Midtown 50s?
Midtown 50. West. I think 55th, between 55th and 56th, right, on 7th Avenue.
So if you want to taste Greek wines.
Absolutely, which a hidden gem. Then, I hate to plug him even more, but he just opened up a cute little wine bar downtown that's called The Athenian.
Greek wine bar?
Little Greek wine bar on 9th Street between 2nd and 1st Avenues. And
cool,
it's wonderful. Yes. It's a tiny place.
What's it called again?
The Athenian.
The Athenian.
And it has like 50 Greek wines by the glass. It's crazy, with really great little food. It's a tiny little bar and two seats in the front. I think it seats like 16 people.
Nice.
But really, if you are studying for your MS and you need to go out there and taste it.
You need to bone up on Greek wines.
Get down there.
That's the place.
But it's a very fun place.
You got any non-Greek places?
Oh, I love Racine's. I love Pascaline.
Arno and Pascaline.
You know, I just went down there the other day, and it's just such a fun, casual place.
And they brought Paul Liebrand in.
Yes. You know, I think it's an excellent place. A doll.
Yes, and I think
professional, too.
The whole experience.
Absolutely.
The selection, the knowledge, and all that. Those are all good choices. Now, do you have a favorite all-time wine or a couple all-time wines? And it doesn't have to be like, you know, the Romani Conti. It could be experiential, event, birthday.
I mean, I have millions, you know.
Okay.
But I, you know, at one point I was at Beau Gravier in the Rhone and had an old, I think it was 1990 Chave Hermitage. You know, that's classic. And they do like a little truffled eggs things. Again, the eggs.
Perfect.
But that was fantastic. Last summer I was in Tuscany and I was staying at Castello d'Arma, and they have their San Lorenzo. And I had this lovely little zucchini and carrot like torta with saffron sauce. And this is, you know, red wine, but it had seen some age. It was fantastic. So, you know, I love food and wine.
That's the experience.
Right.
That's
right.
Why it's not
Absolutely.
Always, you know, some
Absolutely.
Fancy schmancy
Absolutely.
Burgundy. It's the time and the place and all of that. All right. Tap into your knowledge and experience and recommend to my listeners best wine around $15, $15-$20. Give me a red, give me a white. You can give me a category, a region, a specific wine. Like you could say Muscadet or give me a white, give me a red.
White, I hate to say it, but Greek wines, there's a lot of great Greek wines.
I agree.
I had a friend who has a gallery, and he wanted me to choose some wines the other day for him, and he gave me like a $14 limit. So I went into Astor and I found some great wines. They're white and red for, you know, under $14. You know, so I definitely was there. One was Notius.
N-O-T-I-O-S.
And it's made by Yaya, G-A-I-A. They don't pronounce the G.
Okay.
And he makes fantastic wine, Yannis Pedeskovopoulos. Don't ask me to spell that.
Pedeskovopoulos, right?
Okay. But that was, you know, I think like $12 is a white and a red.
Great value,
fun
great
wine. It's Roditis and Savatiano.
All right, so that's white.
White, right?
Give me a red.
Red, I don't know. Lately,
it's
I've been interested in Italian reds, like Canino di Sardegna. You know, I mean, that is, you can get, I was in also Astor. They had a 2013 from Mosca, it's like a Stella and Mosca, like a old world classic blend for $13.
Wow.
I mean, that's like that has always have true value.
So
where'd
you say that's from? Sardinia?
Sardinia. Right,
okay,
right.
So Sardinian wines.
Right, Canninau, and that's
Campania,
really...
Campania, Sardinia, Puglia, right, even right. Sicily are great values.
I know, and also like Montepulciano d'Abruzzo, which used to be like the big liter
right.
bottles, but
now
that is getting hip, and I'm pouring one at the restaurant, and I was afraid to put it on, thinking, and it's like the flies off the list.
Because it's delicious.
I know.
All right, so those are great ones. I'm going to post those so everybody knows. We're going to wrap up the show. We taste wine, and I'm glad to have the pleasure to taste wine with you. Every week, we taste a different wine on air. For our weekly wine sip this week, we're going to taste, and it shouldn't be a surprise to anyone because I'm no dummy, a 2017 Sigalas Acertico white wine from Santorini in Greece.
Now, let's go backwards, Beth. Is Sigalas the way to pronounce it?
Sigalas.
Sigalas.
And the gentleman's name is Paris Sigalas.
And Assyrtiko?
Assyrtiko is perfect.
Okay.
Assyrtiko.
Right. And it's a wine from Santorini in Greece. This wine retails for about $23, $25, $26. Not cheap, but they're one of the great producers that's available that makes consistent wines. Tell me a little more about the grape, the maker, the wine. Okay. What can you tell me?
In 1997, I was pouring this by the glass.
Okay, before anybody.
No, and Milos. Yes, probably before right. most people. And this is the way that they grow the grapes. They're trained in a basket-like form, because if they were put up in a trellis in Santorini, because of the elements and the sun, it would just destroy them. So they, when you actually go, and when I first went to Greece, I thought they were like squash plants or something like that, because they're trained very low to the ground to protect them in lava soils. So this wine is like powerful, amazing fruit, lime rind, you know, incredible acidity. We have like crudos and ceviche at the restaurant, and this would just cut through and go with anything.
You're getting ahead of me. Let's let's evaluate it. So let's go color first. It's a beautiful... color. Like pale yellow?
Absolutely, absolutely. Like clear. Light honey.
Yeah. So beautiful color. Now, jump back in. Let's talk nose first.
Okay.
What do you get on the nose here?
I get like tart fruit, almost like, dry
grapefruit,
apricot.
Citrus.
Absolutely.
Dry, right.
Absolutely.
Dry, not apricot, right. Dry apricot. Mineral?
Absolutely, but some real, yes, I see the grapefruit and... and a little like citrus rind. There's like a real like limey citrus rind.
Definitely
and
citrus.
A little bit of like a beeswax note.
All right, let's throw it over the tongue now, okay? I'm spitting right now.
So this is rich and powerful.
Mouthfeel is medium plus.
Medium plus.
Full for this type of
very
white wine.
Full flavored, bold style, and it is dynamic in your mouth. Like the acidity is like searing.
Great acidity.
Unbelievable.
Dry.
Very dry.
Nice dry though.
But you still have that lovely fruit, that dried fruit element that's just gorgeous, whether it's the tangy citrus and that little kind of dried apricot peach.
Yeah. The nose carries through to the palate, for sure.
Absolutely.
It's a pretty long finish.
Absolutely.
For a white wine like
right.
this.
Absolutely.
Mean, it lingers very nicely.
Absolutely.
The other thing is, and tell me if it has any proximity to where the grapes are grown, there's a salinity to it.
Absolutely.
Is
totally.
That from the air
sure,
or whatever?
Sure,
do
sure.
you pick up that salinity?
Yep.
All right,
it
so,
almost has a, you know, definitely like a salty note.
Yeah,
wonderful.
But nice.
Yeah, yeah,
not
totally,
off-putting
totally,
at
totally,
all.
Totally.
You know, work, it melds in with everything. What's the recommended or classic pairings with a wine like this?
Fish with some grilled fish with some lemon. Capers would be delicious. That would be something that would be classic, but, you know, a lot of things that, you know, some people even, you could have this wine with some kind of a chicken or
right.
pork would be wonderful,
would
too, with rosemary
to
pork, with rosemary, like roasted pork.
Do we like this wine?
I love this wine.
Now, it's a 2017.
Right.
What do you do with a wine like this? Is it drinking well now? Do you buy this wine and put it down?
Well, I think there's a few schools of thought with this matter. At one point, we were all drinking the freshest wine. And now people are coming around to say, you know, this wine is delicious now, but put it down for a few years and, you know, it will be even more so. But for a while, we all drank the freshest wine.
But you could do both.
Absolutely.
You could
Absolutely.
Buy it off the shelf and have this delicious, crisp, fresh
right.
wine.
Well, that's what's cool about Molivos. He has taken a lot
He's
of
aged.
His, yes. And so you really have that opportunity at great prices to...
So what happens? So you take this wine, because it's a quality maker. Mm-hmm. You lay it down for 2-3 years. You open it up. What are the differences we're going to see?
I think you're still going to see the acidity, but the fruit was going to mellow out a little bit more. You know, the whole thing is just going to be a little bit more elegant and subtle. This
the
is a big, powerful
citrusy is going to calm down.
A little bit,
You'll
yes.
get that and
yes.
all of that.
All right. I mean, this is almost a wine now to be drunk alone because, you know, it's amazing.
Yeah, it is that type of wine. Price point, not cheap, right?
No. but not expensive
for this kind of wine.
And I think if you think of the process, is like you know, amazing that people have to train the grapes and they have to pick them low to the ground, and nobody wants to do this. And so they're trying to get these funds together to save the wines in Santorini, because a lot of people just want to have a jewelry shop and
right.
don't have a broken back.
This is like a pain in the ass. Yeah, forget that.
And especially the youth that are coming in are like, forget it.
Yeah, millennials. all right, so that's the 2017 Cigales Assyrtiko. It's a white wine from Santorini, Greece. Beth and I loved it. I agree with her. It's about $25. It's a wine that you should bring to a nice dinner, to nice friends,
Absolutely.
And it would be a treat for everybody.
Or give to a wine geek or right. someone who really likes right. wine. It's really a special.
Yep. I'm glad we liked it. All right, Beth, we're going to wrap up. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. I'm going to post all of Beth's recommendations. I'm going to post her wine list answers. And I'm going to post our weekly wine sip wine. So we'll put a lot of information there. You could follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby. And you can now follow hashtags. So follow the hashtag The Grape Nation. On Twitter, we're at BenRuby and The Grape Nation. Also, subscribe to The Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. Now, Beth, if we want to know more about you on social media or anywhere else.
I am Beth Von Benz on Instagram.
And
I
also have BethVonBenz.
Right? And I also have MVB Consulting. That's
your company?
Absolutely, MVB.
If you need not just a Greek wine specialist, but somebody who's very experienced and savvy in the business, you can talk to Beth. And you can go online
absolutely.
To
MVBConsulting.com. Absolutely.
Okay. All right. I want to thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Pretty much get everything in. I appreciate you being aware of that. So I want to thank our guest, Sharon Harris from Rare Cat Wines. And I want to thank Beth Von Benz from MVB Consulting. Thank you to our engineer, Vitor, as always. And we want to thank everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.